Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader. Today, our guest is Marie Matsuki Mockett, author of American Harvest, God, Country, and Farming in the Heartland. Marie's memoir, Where the Dead Pause and the Japanese Say Goodbye, was a story about, not really a story, the truth about the 2011 earthquake in Japan and her family's 350-year-old Buddhist temple. The memoir was a New York Times editor's choice and an Indie Next pick. Her first novel, Picking Bones from Ash, was shortlisted for the Silverian International Prize for Writing. She's written for the New York Times. She's written for Salon, National Geographic, Glamour, and you've heard her on All Things Considered. You can actually go on LitHub today or in a week or so and see some of her articles there. I just read one about the difference between Japanese fairy tales and American fairy tales, specifically with regard to Cat in the Hat. I actually read that.
You'll never look at that book the same way again.
No, definitely not. So, but before Marie starts talking, which she will, I do want to say that the book itself is about lots and lots of things. Combines, how to fix them. This is where you're supposed to laugh.
Okay.
It's about dessert. It's about rodeo. It's about coyotes. It's about pigs. It's about sunsets. It's about Buddhism. It's about Christianity. It's about farming. And it is about harvesting, the food that we put on our tables every day. It's about harvesting in the sense of gathering information, as she does copiously in this book, harvesting people in the sense of getting to know them, harvesting stories of those people and their lives, harvesting friends, which she does on this trip, and harvesting a lot of knowledge and wisdom, which she then imparts to us in a really eloquent and interesting way. It's a very long, in the sense of being very good, and very thorough discussion that really is a perfect story for the backdrop of America as we find it today. So thanks so much for writing it, and thanks for being here today with us, Marie.
Thank you. Is there dessert every day in your life?
You have an excellent memory.
What is your most recent dessert?
As you know, I'm somewhat forgetful, but last night we had some kind of cobbler, which was really good. And ice cream sandwiches, and my girlfriend's daughter took one, and she had already told her, don't start eating your ice cream until everybody gets theirs. And she took it really and started eating it, and she took it away from her, and I said, come on, give her another shot. And then my daughter goes, Dad, none of your business. And I said, come on, she doesn't mean anything by it. So we got into trouble for that one, because it isn't anything.
I've been holding out, and I had not had dessert, and then I saw this article in the New York Times on perfect pound cake as comfort food. So I made the cake with a Meyer lemon from the garden here in California. And my son, I said, hey, look, I made cake. And he said, yeah, but it's lemon cake, and I hate lemon. So, of course, that meant I had to eat the entire pound cake myself.
If it's a pound cake, do you ever make poppy seed cake?
I do.
That's my favorite cake in the world. And it always reminds me of The Hobbit.
Interesting. I just found, because my mother was always waiting for the days of starvation post-World War II to return, the pantry is extremely well stocked. And I did just find her backup supply of poppy seeds. So I could make lemon poppy seed count, but I would still be the only one to eat the entire cake. So I don't know. I got to weigh these things in my mind.
Yeah. I'm kind of like your son. I would prefer just the regular poppy seed cake, unless you can make the lemon kind of elusive in a Buddhist sense.
Right. Yes. Yeah, I think that because he's 10, he's just hoping we can do another round of brownies.
Yeah, there's nothing wrong with that. But like I said, I haven't actually said this yet, but I've been eating a lot of Fritos scoops with Lipton's French onion dip.
Oh, my. Okay, so that's something that I will have to see. I'll have to check that out if it's in stock in the grocery store here the next time I go.
This is like a Fellini movie now. Yeah, because when you go to the store, you don't know why things are missing. I mean, you know toilet paper and paper towels are going to be missing, but there's a whole section of ziti missing, or there's a whole section of, like, Spam missing, and Hormel stock is doing really well because of it.
I think that hoarding Spam is a very good idea. In these times, I think that people hoarding Spam are brilliant. I will tell you that after 4 weeks of eating my own food, I'd kind of had it, and I did a very brave and daring thing. I ordered pizza, and I went and picked it up, and at the pickup place, the restaurant which made the pizza was also selling
gloves, on gloves and masks.
Yes, they were. Yeah, and I meant to take a picture, but then I had gloves on, and I didn't know if I should touch my phone to take the picture, because then I'd have to, like, wipe down the phone afterward if I took it out of my pocket. Anyway, these are the choices that we face every day.
You think we can go through the whole thing?
No, I don't.
Well, yeah, I'm just going to put this out there, and it'll be like a performance art thing.
Why not? You know, I mean, sometimes interesting things are born out of tremendous pressure. We're all under all this pressure. Yeah.
All right, I'll figure it out. One of the things that was really interesting was, and I was talking to my daughter about this, was when you talk about dealing with the harvesters that you're traveling, we'll talk about basically what the concept of the book is in a minute, but when you're talking about traveling with the harvesters that you're traveling with, the idea that they believe that dinosaurs and man walked the earth at the same time 4,000 years ago. I see, look, you're laughing now. And I told my daughter this, and she says, wow, that's really stupid. And then I thought back to what you were just saying, and I was thinking, why am I saying that's stupid? I mean, some people, and I told her this too, I said, some people feel that God planted the fossils as a test of our faith.
Yeah.
And they actually believe that. And I can't disprove that. But at the same time, why is my knee-jerk response just to think of these people as being stupid? I remember the dumbass Republican debate, the first one, when there were 15 candidates up there, and they said, do any of you believe in evolution? Or no, who here believes in evolution? No one raised their hands because they couldn't. So that's what you do. You stop yourself from thinking that things are stupid.
Yes, largely because I didn't think it was going to help. It may, in fact, be stupid. One of my favorite stories that didn't make it into the book was when I was talking to a geologist who, you know, everybody's always trying to find more fossil fuels in the United States, but particularly in the Great Plains area, because there's a lot of biological matter that's decomposing, you know, from the Great Inland Sea that used to rest in over the Great Plains. And I was talking to this geologist, and he was explaining to me how he goes out and talks to farmers to try to get them to let him have rights to their land to test drill to see if there's anything in the sediment below the ground. And I said to him, are any of them 6 days? And he said, oh, absolutely. And I said, so they don't believe that, that millions of years have passed. And he said, oh, no, not at all. And I said, have any of these people ever had oil on their land? And he said, oh, yes. And I said, so then they get a check. And he said, oh, yeah, they get a check. And I said, do they go on believing that the world was created in 6 days and the earth is only 6,000 years old. And he said, oh, absolutely, you know, but they collect the check.
Yes. It's like when you, I like when you, remember when you take a slice of cake of the earth and you talk about it?
Yeah.
I really like that. That was a good metaphor. Not really a metaphor. What was it? You took, made it like a slice of cake. Oh, yeah. Well, okay. This book is about the idea of the middle of America, which a lot of us take for granted, who are in the whatever percent. And it's this place where you fly over and you look down and you see these circular things that are sprinklers, and you see other fields and all kinds of nothingness and little towns and things like that. And people forget about it, but it's basically everything that isn't New York and California. And right. The book is about these professionals who harvest. So tell us a little bit about how, one, you and your family got interested in that, or how your family started that, and then how these professional harvesting teams developed.
So, I mean, a lot of us whose forefathers came to the United States in the 19th century would have had farms in the heartland through the Homestead Act, which in and of itself was a fascinating piece of history that I didn't know. Different permutations of the Homestead Act essentially meant that individual men, it was usually men, were given 160 acres, sometimes more, of free land to farm. And it was one of the ways in which Western expansion was managed, and the white man was given the land to settle. And this happened because it happened in 1863, I think, when the Civil War was already underway, and the U.S. government had tried to pass the Homestead Act before this, but had not been able to pass it because the southern states didn't want the Homestead Act to pass, because that would probably mean that states would be settled by men who didn't have slaves, which would then tip the balance in favor of free states over slave states. And then once the Civil War was underway, Lincoln thought, okay, they're not going to stop us from having the Homestead Act because the southern states have seceded, and they quickly passed the Homestead Act. So my family, really well after the Civil War, in one of the kind of the last periods of time when people got free land in Nebraska, got a bunch of acres of land in Nebraska and set up a farm. And so that would have been my great-grandfather, I think it is, on both sides of my family. Both of them had farms in Nebraska. They both came from elsewhere. They became the prairie town doctor and dentist and built up their farms. And I think a lot of people come from families that settled the Midwest in the same way, but most people left their farms. And my family never left the farm. Even though they left Nebraska, they held on to the land and continued to farm it with the help of people who live on the ground, and then with the help of custom harvesters. And there are about 450 custom harvester organizations in the United States. It's hard to get hard data on it, but I've been told they cut about 50% of the grain, or 50% of the wheat that the United States produces. And every summer we have had for, you know, decades, we've had custom harvesters come through, and we pay them a fee, and they cut our wheat and deliver the wheat to various storage facilities. And I have developed a friendship with both the farmers who farm the land, meaning they plant the wheat and fertilize it, et cetera, and with the custom harvesters who come in and cut the wheat. And Eric, who's the main character in the book, in particular, has a lot of, he wouldn't necessarily recognize this in himself, but he has a lot of intellectual curiosity about the world, never been to college. But he enjoyed sharing the way farming works with me. And I'm, you know, very different from the kind of agricultural, rural person he normally interacts with. I really liked learning from him. And he was also, even though he was a lifelong Republican, really freaked out about Donald Trump, thought that this was going to be a disaster for the country. And then Donald Trump was elected in 2016. And then to sort of make a long-winded answer short, he said, why don't you come with me on the road and let me show you the way that what the country looks like, and then you can write about it. So that's sort of an all-in-one answer.
Well, it's interesting when you, since you're mentioning Eric, and he is the kind of, if you want to call it, if this was a novel, he'd be the protagonist, almost yeah. like Henry Fonda in Grapes of Wrath. but, you know, if this was a Narnia series, Eric would be like Aslan. I mean,
right.
this is, yeah. it is, I mean, it's kind of like a Christian allegory. So you're definitely drawn to him. Even in the early pages, when you were younger, and you went with your father out there, what was it that so, and I don't mean any of this like in a physical or anything like that kind of sense. What is it that drew you to him immediately? And talk a little bit about that farmer thing where when the guy, bumper is loose and you walk, when the farmer non-threateningly walks towards you with his hands in his pockets, kind of.
That's yeah, right. all the, it's so funny. All the guys are like this. They all carry, I think I say they all carry pliers, which is true. They all have pliers at their belts. And they all hook their hands and they're either in their, in the loops for their, where their belts are or in their pockets, and they walk very, very slowly. They're all very, very calm, temperamentally very calm people. And they're, you know, they're the farmers who are in the book. Do not farm animals. This is a point that they all make to me, that they don't farm animals and they don't want to farm animals, or they used to farm animals and they don't want to farm them anymore. That's how they speak of animals. And they harvest crops, and they're really calm, patient people, or they work hard at being that way. I don't really know, you know, what, I have no idea what chemistry is in friendship or otherwise. I think my father had always said to me, you know, if I die, which he did, he said, if I die, I want you to trust Ray, who's got a smaller part in the book, and you can trust Eric, and they will help you with the farm. And so then he died. And so then I said to Ray and to Eric, oh, my dad said that I'm supposed to trust you. And they are the kind of men who hear that and take that very seriously. And I don't know. I guess I think that that's kind of interesting, that within the world of human relationships, they would take that sort of request from someone who's dying very seriously and take that on as something that's a responsibility they wanted to fulfill. And in terms of, you know, what is so interesting about Eric, I think I found there to be something incredibly authentic about the way that he lives his life. And as I said, he has a lot of curiosity and a lot of intellectual curiosity. It doesn't necessarily register in the way that we think of intellectual curiosity in our, you know, in our urban literary city life. But he absolutely has it. And he asks really great questions. There's probably something about him that reminded me of my father in this kind of intelligent wholesomeness that my dad also had. My dad was actually born in California but grew up in Nebraska and was indeed the sort of person who would play the UC Bierling singing the, and Robert Merrill singing the Pearl Fishers as we drove across country. But he was also somebody who, he was a farmer. So he would fix my car. He would, repair the house. He did everything himself in the same way that the guys do in this book. And so there's probably a quality of that, that sort of do it yourself honor that, my dad had that I recognized in Eric that made me curious and wonder, you know, what is this?
It's funny. You're the only other person I know besides me that when they say that their parent died, they start laughing.
Oh, it was so sad when he died. It was awful.
What?
It just, it just, you know, I think back and being told, well, if I die, you can, you know, do X, Y, and Z. And then I realize, oh, that's because he knew on some level he was dying. Which it, at the time it just felt really alarming to be told, if I die, do these things. But he, you know, it was because he had that awareness. And I think that that's, horribly sad, and weird in that. And then, I guess I did laugh, didn't I?
Well, it's kind of noble too. I mean, the thing about my mom was, she was 90. She just died, June 21st.
I'm sorry.
That's the thing. Don't be sorry. I mean, she had like this wonderful death. She just happened to die when every single person who was in her family happened to be there that day.
Wow.
And she did it on purpose. But I mean, she had her last year of her life was the happiest year of her life. She loved being in the hospital. She said she was going to buy, she said, if they let me stay here, I'll buy a wing of the hospital. I said, why don't you just buy the whole bird, Mom? And, she sang every day. She laughed every day. And the day she stopped singing or laughing, I knew it would be the last day. And it was June 21st, which was a summer solstice. So she squeezed every bit of light out of 95 years. And when she died, there's three of us, three boys. And when she died, the three of us were gathered around her bed. And it was just like we were sitting around the kitchen table. And she just like took a breath and that was it. And
oh, that's amazing.
And then so then in my bookstore, I'm sitting there, someone comes in, it's all broken up because her father died like 6 months ago and she was crying about it. And then I go, yeah, my mom died last month. And I started laughing hysterically. And that was the last time I think she came into the bookstore.
Amazing. Well, it changes you, right? Particularly if you have a close relationship with your parents. It's just,
I mean,
it's not
something
you get to go through again and again. You only lose your biological parent like that once.
Someone told me that no matter how old you are, when your last parent dies, you're an orphan.
That's right.
So anyway, and I don't mean to sound flippant. I mean, I laugh out of love for her. I don't laugh because, you know what I mean? I mean, it's like, I think of it kind of as a blessing the way she went. Not like unfortunately your dad, but I mean, in this case, it was the way you're supposed to. It goes back to your book, which we should go back to, which is the idea that there's like this infinite loop. There's this infinite amount of uncertainty, which is Marie's question that you and your father are talking about when you're driving back. The other reference, is that you talk about Dr. Quantum's YouTube video.
Yes.
I watched several times.
It was helpful, right?
Yeah. I mean, the double slit experiment has been bothering me for 50 years, more than 50 years.
I'm with you.
It's like, a wave and a particle and behaves the same time. You know the acceleration, but you can't know the location. Drives me crazy.
Did you read the Stephen Hawking book and like still not get it? Because that's what happened to me. I read and is it A Brief History of Time? Is that his book? Yeah. I read and reread and reread and was like, I'm still not understanding this thing about the particle. And then I asked my uncle, who was a particle physicist, and he made me feel bad for not understanding, and I gave up on it. And then Dr. Quantum's YouTube video comes out, and within a few minutes, I'm like, oh, I get it.
I've always liked the idea that the observer changes, and we talked a little bit about this before, too, kind of. The observer changes the very thing that's being observed.
Yes.
And I mean, that's really weird.
It is. I mean, it makes sense now. As I get older, I think, oh, yeah, that totally makes sense. And, one of the things, since we're talking about, how the book was written, I went into this book thinking I'm going to just try to be like some kind of John McPhee or Ian Fraser, impartial person, writing about what I'm singing. But I kept running into this problem, which is that people kept thinking that I was Mexican or Native American, which probably didn't happen to John McPhee when he was out looking at geology. And I'm pretty sure Ian Fraser was also not mistaken for Native American when he was riding the Great Plains. And it finally became a problem that I couldn't avoid, and I had to work it into the book. And so then when I turned in the first draft, which, as I mentioned, was long, and you might enjoy the fact that it was 666 pages. But anyway, Ethan, my editor, said, you know, you can't do this. You can't show up on page 80. You have to show up in the beginning of the book. And I said, well, but, you know, John McPhee doesn't put in his selfness on page one. Why do I have to do that? And the fact of the matter is that it's what I have written is a reflection of my being present in the story. And it does make me think how accustomed we are to this sort of objective, you know, narrator writing about what he is seeing. And I realize, oh, I guess all along what we thought of as the sort of impartial and objective voice was who was invisible, really wasn't probably invisible in any of those descriptions of the land. You know, any travel narrative where we read now, like a 19th century colonial travel narrative, was probably the behavior that they observed was probably in being impacted by their presence. And it wasn't neutral. So I think about this. This is one of the things I think about a lot now.
You brought up for the first time, and then we can discuss your heritage a little bit, but you brought up the first time that you're not white. So what happens is it reminded me, two things in the book reminded me of one another. One was the way you described the way back in early Christianity, a man would draw a curve in the sand, and the other man would draw the reverse curve, which created the fish, which let each of them know that they were Christians. And then you talk about how when you pass somebody who is of mixed heritage, you give them the nod or they give you the nod. But with someone who's African American or Latino or whatever they are. And it's interesting. And for people who are, I guess, what do you want me to call them? Real Americans? You want me to call them, I never liked WASP because it shouldn't really be WASP because there are no non-white Anglo-Saxon Protestants. So it should be ASP, right?
Oh, gosh. Oh, yeah. Well, that needs to become a New Yorker cartoon, I think.
New Yorker cartoons suck now. They used to be so good. I don't know what I was saying. Being Jewish, there's a kind of intimation I can get of this. But
absolutely.
But, so did you find when you traveled that you were constantly, well, you do because you tell it. Talk about how you're constantly being questioned. And even when you go to Japan, go ahead, you talk about how you're.
I think that that's true. Sort of in any environment, I don't quite blend into the landscape. The only place where I ever felt like I kind of blended in was in Hawaii. Which everybody had said to me, if you go to Hawaii, nobody's going to wonder where you're from. They're all going to assume that you're from the island. And then they would always say, and you should always try to get the local discount, which was the other thing I was always advised to try to do. But you know, that's true. My mother's Japanese, as in from Japan, as in spoke to me in Japanese when I was growing up. So I'd speak Japanese. And my father, as he would say, is a rare breed born in California and then returned to Nebraska where he grew up. So I'm mixed race in that way. And the very lucky recipient of having been brought up with more than one language and with direct access to Japan all the time since I was a kid, although not now since there's a travel restriction in place. And so I'm what they call an other. And you know, I think it's hard. I find it sometimes difficult to talk about because I'm also a person of extreme privilege. So, you know, I never want to sound like, I've been injured in some way because I'm acutely aware of how I have a lot of good fortune. And I don't know where this question is going. But it is true. I was going through the heartland and, felt kind of naked in a way that, I don't on a daily basis if I'm in New York City, or even in San Francisco, because there were so many white people. I was just surrounded by white people. There was the team that I was with. And you know, and that's really hard. The other main character in the book is Justin, who is 23, I think, in the book, and who is Eric's son. And it's, Justin gets very sad when he hears that I felt out of place because it was so important to him to make me feel comfortable and welcome, which I, you know, which I really mostly was. But I did feel very exposed physically in a way, traveling through farm country because it was so incredibly white. And it's also true that when I go through Japan, when I was a child, if I was with my mother, I always felt like I had her as cover because she was super educated and very, very Japanese. But when I go through Japan now, I very obviously am not Japanese to the Japanese. Sometimes they will think I might be Japanese for like a few minutes. And then after a few minutes in conversation, they'll suddenly say, wait a second, you're not Japanese. And then I have to say, yeah, that's true. I'm not. So I do often have this feeling of being kind of physically exposed in a way that is not always comfortable because I'm not necessarily somebody who wants to go through life standing out in that way.
Well, but you don't not attempt in the book. It's not attempt. It's something that you bring out periodically to bring us back to like our home base. And okay, there's a number of reasons you don't fit in. One, because of what we just discussed, but then because you aren't a harvester and they won't, you know,
right.
They don't.
Yes. Yes.
And you can't get out of the mud at the rodeo and they're not going to let you do it. Things like that.
Like with a bunch of teenagers who insist on driving the car because they do not have the confidence that I can get the car out of the mud. Yeah.
Right. You're an 8-year-old.
Pretty much. Yeah. And then they have their own sort of internal tension and argument over who gets to drive the car because one is a woman and the other one is an old order Mennonite who only made it to 8th grade but is a man and thinks he should be allowed to drive the car. And like the number of things that I'm computing at that point. You know, do I insist on driving the car? Do I turn the car over? And then who do I pick? Yeah, that's really interesting. You learn a lot about people in these situations, I tell you, when you take yourself out of the world that you're normally accustomed to.
Well, it's, yeah, and most people don't do it because they're scared to do it, you know?
Well, it's not comfortable always.
I was just going to say that. The worst thing in the world to do is become comfortable.
I the funny thing is like I'm not a daredevil, you know, like I'm not gonna go bungee jumping. I have never tried like hard drugs. I'm not really a crazy person, but then a friend of mine said to me, well, you really put yourself in these really uncomfortable situations to write books. So I guess I do that. You know, I had a lot of comfort really on this trip. I mean, I had a whole trailer I was in. I had my own trailer, which I shared with Bethany. So it's not like I was roughing it, but I did feel very exposed for all the reasons that you mentioned. One of which is that I also asked too many questions and used too many words compared to the harvesters.
Yeah, I know. I like when you, I can just see you describing the sunrise and the sunsets to them without trying to get to work.
Yeah, and they're like, oh man, here again, she's going to tell us to look at the, you know. But, I mean, that was the one time when the moon was rising and the sun was setting and that was happening at the same time, and I just thought that was so awesome. But, yeah, they were like, oh, here she goes again.
You know what really upset me the most about the book, though?
What is that?
Why was that the most foul fried chicken you ever had? I would have assumed it would have been really, really good. I was like so excited, and then it was horrible.
Yeah, I was. Oh, you really want to take me back to that? It was still probably the worst fried chicken I've ever. I'm not even sure. I don't know.
I mean,
you can have, you know, a sort of a poorly sourced chicken to start with, but then usually one compensates with some sort of additional seasoning. You know how you read those reports of like how somebody got fried chicken and then it turned out not to be chicken, but it was like rat or something. I don't know if that's an urban legend. I still imagine that in those circumstances, the person had a tasty meal.
Yeah.
Right?
Oh, yeah.
Like he was, like he was compensated for by expert timing in the oil or some incredible combination of spices. And this was not even that. Like, it was just failure on all levels. There was no pretense of, we're going to try to, it may be bad chicken, but we fried it really well, or, you know, it just was terrible.
I just realized you did actually use the word foul. Did you?
it was foul.
Did you do it on purpose to make the pun?
No, in fact, I did not think of that until this point. It wasn't even like I did word search thesaurus. What word can I use other than bad? You know, I think foul was there from the very first draft.
It's like, you know, people do that a lot with puns. Like I've been listening on all this on CNBC on stock stuff. When they talk about an airline stock, they'll say, yeah, it's got a lot of tailwinds now, or they've got a lot of headwinds. And they don't even know that they're doing it. I mean, people tend to pun within the profession they're in.
It's true. When we elected somebody, not we, but we, the country has elected somebody named Trump. I mean, you know, there's a lot to do with that as well. Yeah, it's true.
Yeah. Well, like I was talking, well, I don't know, who knows, I might even have said it to you. But I was talking to someone, the last interview, we were just an hour ago. When this all started like 5 years ago, my friend and I, Mike and I, we kept saying, you can't make this stuff up. But then we kept saying, you can't make this stuff up. And then it got weirder and weirder, so I don't know what you're supposed to say now.
Yeah, it's we were talking about this before the recording started.
And, we were. Sorry.
It is true. This isn't a show, and we don't. One of the things that my son and I have been doing while we have been sheltering, he's 10, and we have been watching Star Trek, and we've made it all the way through Classic Trek, and then it was a little hard for him, but he agreed to watch The Next Generation. He did not like the redesign on the ship, but despite that, we've managed to successfully become attached to the Next Generation series. And, you know, there are always these episodes in Star Trek where the characters end up in some parallel reality, you know, and the parallel reality is really bad. Like in Classic Trek, there's one where parallel reality Kirk is like a brute. But fortunately, parallel reality Spock is still really rational and figures out that the parallel reality good Kirk is not his captain. And anyway, by the end of every single Star Trek episode, order gets restored, right? And the major chord theme ending music comes on and everything's resolved and it's okay. And that is not the story that we're in. I think we've been waiting for us to be able to say, well, you can't make this up, and then the story resolves, you know, and we get sort of normal parallel reality back. And that's just not what's happening. The storyline just keeps continuing.
I know, and it's so strange. When they had the last State of the Union address, the designated survivor was Rick Perry. I mean, what can you say? You can only say you can't make this up.
Well, and now my husband is from Scotland, and so he's and never was a Boris Johnson fan, but now we have Boris Johnson in the ICU, and the question is, you know, if something happens to him, what do they do? They don't know. It's I think if I can selfishly draw this back to one of your initial questions, I have always been aware on some level, and I'm even more acutely aware now, that the story that we're in, right, is always a broader story than the one that's right in front of us. And so it's not like there's our reality and then the parallel reality, which we can reject, and then we can return back to the nice Starship Enterprise with Captain Shakespeare, is what my son calls Picard. Our world is always intersecting with all of these other worlds all the time. And so what's really hard is to ask our imaginations, right, to take in those other worlds, which are super uncomfortable and feel wrong. And I do think that there's like a level at which, obviously, there's all this weirdness that's going on that that makes us say, wow, this can't be happening. And yet it is. And these are all people who are in our world too. And, however this resolves, it's probably going to resolve by asking us to understand what some of those weird realities are. We don't just get to hit the reset button, I think.
Did you watch Game of Thrones?
I watched it until a certain point. I did not watch it all the way through. I am aware of the dissatisfaction with the ending with the Game of Thrones.
Did you watch the first year with Ned Stark and when he got killed?
Yes.
Okay, so Dr. Fauci is the new Ned Stark. Dr. Fauci doesn't understand that people can be dishonest and wrong and evil, and he doesn't understand why they can't accept the truth and why they would undercut him or lie to him or betray him.
Yes. It's true. I think I did say in the book at one point that I don't understand what a human being is, but I think I only say it once if I say it at all. But it is the thing I wandered around with for a long time after finishing the book, thinking, wow, I really have to adjust my understanding of what the human psyche is and what people are. And, you know, I don't have an answer, like a sound biteable answer to the question of what is a human being, but there is an element of that at play with this weirdness that we see in the news.
But it's no different, really. I mean, we can go back.
That's exactly right.
We can go back to Henry V, and what's happening there is no different than the things that are happening here.
That's
exactly
right. Yep, I totally agree with you. The human animal is the same.
So you know how you were saying how you like to think about good questions and stuff? So this line in the single line in your book was really something I thought about a lot. It was one sentence, and you said, killing.
It's not about the chicken?
No, it's about the pigs. You said killing piglets would be satisfying,
mm-hmm.
which is an interesting thing. And I thought about that for a long time.
present day Marie sitting here sheltering with her son. I just got a new pole for the bird feeder so that I could put the bird feeder in a better position for us to watch the songbirds. I've put out like different kinds of bird seeds so that I can attract different songbirds. And I was really excited the other day because I think a goldfinch showed up. That person is not the one who wants to be killing piglets. On the other hand, I don't have to deal with piglets. I do have to deal with gophers, and the gophers piss me off, I gotta tell you.
Actually, I do have to deal with piglets because I have a pig downstairs.
Oh my.
And I went to this animal auction. Actually, I have buggies going by my front street every day. I mean, I live within 5 minutes of Amish and Mennonite people, and probably very close to where Eric is from, maybe 20 minutes away.
Where are you?
I'm in Chester County, Pennsylvania, which is...
Sure. Yeah, I know where that is.
Yeah, it just ties into Lancaster County. It's just got Route 30.
Yes.
And, there's this small animal auction called Green Dragon, and my nephews always drag me there, and they make me buy an animal of some kind, then they take it home, and they put it in their father's bathtub. So the next morning when he wakes up to go into the shower, there's either a pig or a duck or a goat in the bathtub. But then, of course, they can't keep it. So they end up – I have like this hundreds of acres here. So they give it to me and I end up with it. But this time they made me buy a mini pig. And I should have researched it before because apparently there really isn't anything like a mini pig. And as – Justin says, you know, a lot of the Mennonite Amish thing is capitalism. And so they had a box and they just wrote mini pig on it.
They thought some city person is going to get fooled by the mini pig.
actually, with, at the end of the auctioneer goes, not a good buy.
Oh, no.
Which was so embarrassing. And the animal auction is like in this amphitheater that looks like a scene out of The Gladiator. And all the wooden benches are all worn smooth from Amish people sitting there for years. And one time my ex-wife took a picture in there. I thought they were going to kill us.
Interesting. Yeah, you know, I got my requisite text a couple weeks ago when the lockdown was happening in Pennsylvania from one of the guys in the book who wrote to tell me how unconstitutional this was. And how there might be uprisings. And you know, now that I've spent enough time with these guys, the text message, I understood the point of view. I mean, I myself don't feel that way. But it's a totally different world, and it's not necessarily what one thinks. I'm sorry that you have a mini pig.
My daughter likes.
Yeah, you know, the human. This is a thing I will say. Like I'm a, you know, like I said, I'm protecting my songbirds, and my son and I have conversations about how we might attract the California quail back, and so here I am, this peaceful person. As soon as the lockdown happened in California, I began planting vegetables, and, you know, in case there's a disruption to our food supply. But humans are predators, right? The hallmark of the predator is the eyes in the front of the head. And one of the things that this book reminded me of was, yeah, Marie, you're this person of mixed race, and you went to the tsunami plane, and I did all this Buddhist training in Japan from Buddhist masters. But I'm not above feeling the rush of adrenaline when I was out. Actually, they never let me shoot at a pig, which is just as well.
Yeah.
But the entire experience was amazing. And I don't think that because I've done all of these things, including, you know, interesting and weird forms of Buddhist meditation and had visions, and I may have done all that, I'm still a predator. You know, I'm not above any of the ways in which our brains, quote unquote, malfunction or behave inconveniently. And I'm, you know, a writer who's garrulous and spends a lot of time asking questions. But I don't think that I'm above negative aspects of being a human being. And that's why I put that in there, because I was with them, and there was actually a second pig hunting scene that got deleted as part of the 666 pages that were too long. And I would probably not go hunting and have it turn into a hobby for me, but I can see why it's exhilarating for people. And I think until a person lives in that environment and I think maybe the fact that there's a little bit of insecurity around food supply right now maybe makes the idea of hunting a little bit more, or the attraction of it maybe will make it make more sense. But I left that line in on purpose because, you know, there I was in that environment and I could see why they were behaving this way.
It was a good sentence. And the other thing was, I like the way when he comes in his shorts and he says, "Do you want to go pig hunting?" And you go, "Let's go."
Yeah.
You're very enthusiastic. So talking about master classes and Buddhism and all that. So my brother's, you know, Shambhala meditation is what he's been doing for 30 years. So he drags me into it from time to time. And then I always go to the concert for Tibet and all that and follow Uma Thurman around to see if I can get a good look at her and talk to her. But, you know, never happens. And my brother lived in a yurt with Robert Thurman for like 3 weeks somewhere in Tibet.
Oh, amazing.
I know.
The funny thing about Buddhism that I often say to people is, you know, it's an alternative religion here in the United States, but it is not an alternative religion once you're in Asia. So my family runs a Buddhist temple, right? And so for them, it's not an alternative religion. So I don't know. That's just interesting to think about.
Yeah. And the other thing is it's so welcoming. Again, you know, the idea of the attraction between Jewish people to Buddhism, it's interesting because in the book when you're talking about, it's interesting, what was really cool is a lot of times when you're talking about like God waddling around inside of him, and you realizing, wait a minute, he's not, I'm in there waddling around with him, and then talking about how all you know is, you know, this is all confusing to me. Is Jesus, the devil, hell. So what are all these other little things? And then so for Buddhism, for the Shambhala, the bumper sticker I had on my car for 10 years said, nothing happens, you know, because everyone asks, you know, when you meditate, what happens? Nothing happens. And, but then when I went to go see the Dalai Lama in New York for lecturing for 3 days, he's saying things that are so deep and, minute and so many little points about Buddhism. And I'm thinking to myself, shouldn't it just be nothing happens? Shouldn't you just let go of that one thing? Isn't that what Buddhism is? Just let, you know, you're in a parachute and you have a scissors and the chute's open and all you're supposed to do is just take the scissors and cut the lines. That's it. And that should be all Buddhism is, I think.
Right. And he didn't say that.
No, but he spent 3 days lecturing about arcane aspects of things that I didn't understand.
I've been thinking a lot about writing a piece. It's interesting. On my Facebook page, there was somebody who claimed to be a Buddhist, and he was writing at the very beginning of this sheltering in place that started. He was writing stuff about how we had to love the virus, and I thought, okay, that's fine. But then it turned into love the virus, and that if you love the virus, you will boost your immune system, and if you're sick, you will cure yourself. And then I was pissed, because. You know, and then I actually briefly engaged in an argument with him, and then that sort of fortune, like I said, I'm not above, you know, the baser instincts of being a human. And then I stopped myself from arguing with him, but he kept trying to tell me that we once upon a time had the knowledge being to cure ourselves of illness, but we've lost it. And, you know, that's one of these recurring lies throughout history, which is just bullshit. But the thing is, like, every religion has this, way of saying, you know, enlightenment or being one with God or whatever is really simple. You just have to do X. And if you're not doing X, you're not doing it properly. And if you'd be doing it properly, then, you know, you wouldn't get sick, et cetera, et cetera. And one of the things I've been thinking about with any sort of form of religion or spirituality is anybody who tells you that it's easy isn't telling you the truth. Because In any form of religion that avoids ways in which life is uncomfortable and painful isn't being honest. So I feel that way about Buddhism, and I feel that way about Christianity. Christianity matters if it is being applied to people in prison, people in death row, people who are dying. And the same is true of Buddhism. Life is not simple or easy, and like the situation that we're in now with the virus and with like a government that doesn't tell us the truth really sucks, and yet that is part of the human struggle, you know what I mean? There is no sort of parallel Star Trek universe that we get to return to that's normal. We'll have to work toward it and build it, and I believe in that. I believe in being constructive, but I think the idea that this is going to be easy is one of the things that we should perhaps set aside.
You're funny because you know that TNB self interview you did?
No. what was that? TNB?
This is 11 years ago.
Oh, okay. What did I do in that one?
You ask questions of yourself. You go, I hear people think you look like a vegetarian. What's up with that?
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So it's, you're talking about, Miyazaki movies, and you go on this long thing. You ask yourself the question, right? But then you go, where is it? There's a salon critic who doesn't like or get the Miyazaki films, which makes me wonder why she keeps reviewing them, but I digress. Digress from your own question and answer. I don't even know if you can do that.
Maybe I just need Ritalin.
Well, no, I mean, I think that's kind of Buddhist, right? I mean, it's funny because you answer questions the same way that you write.
Well, I mean, thank God for consistency of personality. At least you know it's really me.
That's true. That's another good point.
I mean, I don't fully understand, you know, Buddhism. And that's one of the reasons why I thought, well, I should go to Japan, or because Zen Buddhism, which is so popular here and did become very, I think, partly through the Jewish community in the Beat movement and, you know, all of that. I think it was Soto Zen that came over and was first popular, I think, even before Tibetan Buddhism. I could be wrong, but I think that's the timeline. I thought, well, maybe I should go ask the Japanese Zen masters some of these questions, you know? And then, of course, everything they said to me was so different than what I ran into in the United States. I will say that one of the things I have learned is that when you kind of go ask people in the environment where they're practicing whatever it is you're curious about, one tends to uncover new material. So I don't know what the point of that is. I guess just that's one of the things that has guided what I've tried to do, you know, which is like, if I don't understand what Buddhism is, maybe I should go ask people who have been practicing it in the place for 1,000 years, because they might know something that I don't necessarily get to hear in the United States. Sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say, because I did that nothing happened things and letting go of everything, my parallel view to yours, if not contrasting, is that the only thing that's ever really made sense about any type of thing like religion in my life are Zen koans. Because right. They make no sense at all, and yet they make perfect sense. That's what I'm trying to get to in my life, but I never understood. I mean, you know, it's like Pink Floyd, Comfortably Numb. You know, when they go, when I was a child, I had a van. I turned to look, but it was gone. I cannot put my finger on it now.
Well, I think there's something about being an American, and I am an American, where the narrative is that there is an answer, that life can be comfortable, that our children will do better. You know, all of these narratives are part of our programming. I have a little piece today in Lit Hub, and it's about I years ago wrote a piece on fairy tales and fairy tales in the West and fairy tales in the East for Lit Hub. And then that I have a piece today that's sort of a continuation of this because I've been teaching my students Eastern and Western fairy tales and then looking at novels and sort of trying to see how fairy tales, children's tales, kind of pre-program us to have an understanding of narrative and how that then is reflected in serious novels. And so we began by looking at The Cat in the Hat by Dr. Seuss and this Japanese cat called Nontan, who's a Japanese cat. And both cats make a mess in other people's homes. except the Cat in the Hat, of course, at the 11th hour, cleans up the mess by the aid of superior technology, whereas the Japanese cat has to clean it up himself. And then realizes that for the good of everyone's well-being, the Japanese cat goes and cleans up the messes of his friends' homes, too, which is totally fascinating to me culturally. But, you know, I think it's really hard to shake that feeling as an American that, wait a second, things are supposed to be better. And yet I also think that's a great thing about us. Because I would really like to believe that, you know, that life can be better, that people can be equal, that we can find ways to alleviate suffering, et cetera. And so I really like that Americans think that, even though it also leads us to these moments of, as you said, shock, where we're like, wait a second, you're lying. You can't possibly be lying. You know, it's our great undoing, but I also think it's one of the things about this country that is fantastic and worth sort of preserving. The book explores a lot about American history and some of the ways in which we have these national narratives about how we're the great melting pot and how that's not true. And yet I think that being a melting pot is a great thing to aspire to. So, I mean, I think that's one of the problems is we get these Zen koans which tell us that life is hard, blah, 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 and yet we still want it to be better than it is, you know? And I think that's fine.
Well, so then why do you think, and this actually goes really right back to the book, which is what we're supposed to be doing, why do you think that this divide, if you had to draw a curve, you know, the whole flatten the curve thing, we're not flattening the curve with the divide, how did it start, how is it evolving, and where do you, either apocalyptically or not, feel that it's going?
It's such a big question. You know, the divide isn't only a divide in the United States. Some of what the divide is occurs elsewhere, too. I think there are big splits in terms of city culture and rural culture. We saw that, like, with the Brexit vote in the UK, right? You had people who live in London who were not pro-Brexit and people who were outside of London who are outside of major urban centers who voted differently. That's a divide. That's a reflection of the divide as well. So the divide is a global phenomenon. In some ways, there was a piece I read in The Economist, and it was all about, I forget which country in Africa. I feel like it was Ethiopia, but I'm not sure. And it was about how the country needs farmers, but the minute young people get an education, they want to go live in the city and be designers, you know? Because everybody wants to live like they're in Brooklyn, even if they're not in Brooklyn. And yet we still need food and we need people to produce food. I see this in Japan too. When I travel in rural areas, I go into these rural areas, well, before the travel ban, but, farmers are, you know, an aging population as they are in the United States. So to some degree, the divide is a reflection of the fact that we live and work very differently within the space of a generation. And one of the reasons why we need to overcome the divide is because we do, in fact, need to work together. You know, there was that meme that came out. It comes out every election cycle, themes on how the blue states want to secede and they're going to take their superior tax revenue and blah, 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 blah. And then every now and then the red states respond with, well, that's fine, but we produce the food, you know. And all of that is really true. And there's nothing really sexy or attractive about saying, well, maybe it is sexy to some people to say, actually, we need each other. Cities are not self-sufficient. They do depend on importing resources. And in fact, rural areas are not self-sufficient either. You know, they do depend on the tax revenue from the cities. I am not a pundit or a politician or a policy person, so I'm really uncomfortable saying, here's what we need to do. I'm just a writer who speaks in this discursive manner, apparently. And I tried really hard to pay attention to something that I didn't think was being characterized well. And so I tried to, you know, bring it to life in a way that a writer can. Hopefully to give people room in their imaginations to think about these questions, too. And possibly, you know, I get asked the hope question all the time, like, why should we have hope? And I, like, fail to answer this question well anytime mainstream media asks me, which is why there's no mainstream media article out there with me saying, here are five reasons you should have hope. Because I just don't feel like it's, like, a sound, biteable type of answer that I could give. Realistically, it's really hard for us to communicate with each other, and realistically, we love this binary system, right? I mean, I'm probably one of the few people who just doesn't even get into sports because I really don't like that feeling of rooting for one team over another. But so much of our culture is programmed to make us behave that way.
Yeah. It's interesting how both teams, and, you know, you talk about Friday Night Lights and the six-man football teams. Isn't it funny how before the team, both sides pray and they're both praying for them to win.
Yeah. Yeah, it's really, but secular people get into these sports games too, and it's really hard for me to, it's just really hard for me to, I just don't get into it. I don't know. I don't like rooting for one person over another, even though I did go tag along with the pig hunting, as you point out. I hope, I feel like the most that I can ask is, you know, if you read the book and it opens you up to seeing the humanity or understanding more about where our food comes from and the people who make that happen, then I've sort of done my job. And, you know, no, not everybody gets to go live in a trailer for 5 months and tag along with harvesters, but maybe there are ways in which we can have some of these difficult conversations in our own lives. That would be great if people are able to sort of make room in their imagination for that to happen.
I think that's a good answer because, you know, I'm trying to get you to go all inductive on me and you're not, that's not what your job is. I agree with you. You know,
I feel like it would be really unrealistic. And I, you know, like there have been some really nice media people who wanted me to do it. And I just don't feel like it would be honest if I say, here are the five things we need to do. Or if I, you know, if I were like the bad Buddhist who said, if you love the virus enough, you won't get sick. Like, I feel like I would be lying if I said it's as easy as this, because human history says it's possible and human history also says it's hard. But I do want to say that I believe it's possible, because otherwise I would just, I couldn't get up in the morning if I thought it wasn't possible for us to, you know, make friends with each other and make the world better. I still think that that's possible.
How do you feel when you wake up in the morning?
Totally depends. Like I said, last night I ordered pizza, and so I felt like I ate way too many carbs this morning.
That's it? Well, I guess
you can go. You know, I feel my publisher doesn't like it when I say one voice says this, one voice says that, so we tried to excise a lot of those passages from the book. But, you know, I mean, I feel like I feel like I have to adapt to this new reality, which is really hard, and I don't want to adapt to it. Some mornings I wake up and there's, you know, I don't know if this happened to you when you lost your mother, but there's a moment where you wake up and you're still unaware of the fact that someone who you love has died. And then as you surface from sleep, you're like, oh, wait a second, that person has died. I don't want to wake up. I've had that feeling a lot in the mornings. Other mornings I wake up and I think, okay, this is the reality now. What can I do to, you know, live today to make it good for myself and for my kid? I think people who are parents ask that question of themselves a lot. Other times I think, oh, right. I remember the story my mom told me about how they had no food and so they had to eat grasshoppers, and my life is definitely not that bad, so I can't complain. I've had those mornings too. You know, I have a whole bunch of feelings about where we are in the world right now. I also have mornings, quite frankly, where I wake up and I think, gosh, I remember all the guys in the book who told me, how are the people in the city going to feel when there's an apocalypse and they're totally dependent on us for their food supply? And I think, oh, right, this is what they were talking about, you know? Or the Mormons who took me into their, like, kitchens where they had their secret supply of food that was supposed to last a whole year in case there's some sort of catastrophe. And I think, well, that was really forward thinking.
I know. I had a friend. I feel bad. He just died just before Christmas, my best friend. And we were completely different, but best friends. And he was like, he was longing for the apocalypse so much all his life. And he had all these MREs, these army rations, like 20 years worth. And he had all kinds of ammunition and claymore mines and bazookas. And he had everything was locked and double locked and cameras everywhere. And he also, he was like your father. He knew how to fix everything, no matter right. what it was. And so he helped me out. He did. I mean, he was my best friend. He was my tenant. He was my handyman. He did everything. And so when I wake up now, it's like I miss him because if something breaks, I go, I got to call Rich. And then I go, I can't call him. He's dead. Mm-hmm. And then also I miss him as a friend, but I also miss him because he would be so excited about what's going on now. You know,
oh, that's so funny.
And he just missed it. But now when you're talking, it reminded me of one other thing. And we can talk about there. You can just tell me you want to hang up now too, by the way. Is that how in church you cry when you go to church. You cry when there's, and I find myself doing the same thing too. I mean, sometimes I'll even cry like during a McDonald's commercial or something. If it's, you know, if it's heartwarming. What's that part of you like? And why did that happen? Cause you do explain it. I mean, you don't actually explain it. You explain that you're doing it.
Well, I think it's partly the music, you know, whether it's a McDonald's commercial or a medication commercial or church, they're really good at knowing what kind of music is going to tug at your heartstrings, which is why they use the same keys and chord progressions over and over again, because they know that they're going to get an emotional reaction out of us. And I really love how in churches across America, and I was sort of dimly aware of it because, you know, every time like a new pop star is born, they come out of some Baptist church, right? Like we learned that Justin Timberlake went to church and Justin Bieber went to church and Britney Spears went to church. And then when I started going to churches and everybody could sing, and then like the deeper you go into the world of American Christianity, people sing in four-part harmony. The last time I remember anybody singing in four-part harmony was, you know, maybe like in the Little House on the Prairie books. But here we are in 2020 and people go to church and they can sing in four-part harmony. Like grown men know how to do this. They're not like cool guys in bars who won't go do karaoke because that's like not manly. These are manly men who know how to sing in four-part harmony. This is part of America. So all of that was incredibly moving to me. So I think, you know, I think that's part of it. And there's the scene where I go to the mega church with Justin and I'm like crying my eyes out and we walk out and then Justin says, this is not going to work for millennials forever. You know, like he's over it. He's totally analyzed the music, knows how manipulative it is and thinks it's nonsense. Which I love, to the point that he's written a college paper, comparing Christian music versus what he calls radio songs, which are the songs from our world and not from his. So I think that there's a lot of that was at play, but I also think, I think that, you know, I probably harbored a lot of tension and then I would go into this environment and where people were singing and I found it very moving and it would make me weepy. I don't enjoy being, cynical or arch. It's not a stance that I like to stay in all the time. I'm pretty quick to get, you know, emotional or about things if I can. So I guess I do. But I had no idea when I started the book whether or not I was ever going to have a church experience that felt real. You know, they were all so scripted and phoned in and I actually frankly couldn't even understand what they were talking about most of the time, even though it was one of the reasons I wanted to write this book was because the last two books required me to use the Japanese language, which was hard. And I thought, well, do this book set in the United States and it'll all be in English and that'll be a break. And then I was in church thinking, this is English and I have no idea what they're talking about. But when I finally did have a church experience where suddenly things made sense at an emotional and intellectual level, it was really exciting. So I probably got kind of emotional over that too.
Well, and like you said, yes, that's the purpose of this. And if you could take it to CNN or you could take it to Fox, or you could take it to almost anything that we're listening to now. And you actually said before we started talking about how you have this kind of drone type of internet view of what's going on in the world.
Yeah.
And talk about, how the minister, what's his name? The guy that he has like there's seven mega churches now, so he can only be in reality in one of them and virtually in the other.
Yeah, Craig Groeschel. Yes. Uh-huh.
Yeah. Tell a little bit about that so they can hear.
We had been to Cowboy Church a bunch of times in Texas, which I was not understanding what was happening. I mean, they just would use these English phrases. I now understand. If I were to go to these churches now, I would sort of know what they were trying to tell me. But I didn't understand at the time. And there was a Sunday coming up and Justin, who's kind of like my church tour guy, he's a millennial and he's what we would call a liberal. And he's actually coming. We're doing a virtual event with Marlon James at the Center for Fiction, and Justin's going to be there too. But Justin said, you know, he thought of himself as like my tour guide, which was wonderful. And he said, we're not so far from Oklahoma City and there's a mega church there that I like and I've never been. Would you like to go? And so, it's called Life Church. It's a large church. And he took me to it. And it's like, if you've never been to a mega church, it's like going to some, Broadway show derived version of a church mixed with a TED talk and an incredible corporate presentation with a live band and huge cameras that they use to film sporting events and an incredible sound system and lighting system and then like a procession of live pastors who come in and talk to the audience, and then there's a main pastor who would have started the church, and this pastor's name was Craig Rochelle, and he had apparently started it in his garage, and then his preaching, which is really kind of like a kind of personal motivator, or like a, what is the guy, the one who's like a motivation coach,
Tony Robbins?
Yes, that's like that sort of, yeah, that sort of up with people type motivating speech. He does that, but through the lens of the gospel. But he has a franchise of churches, and he can only be in one at any point. And so there's this always this question of like, is he going to be at the 10:30 service? Is he going to be at the 11:30 service? And if he's not going to be there in person, where are we going to get the recording? And the day that we went, I kept saying, I think we should go in the morning. We should go to the first sermon. I bet he's there. And we didn't go because it would require getting up even earlier and driving to Oklahoma City. We went to the 11 or 11:30 service and we got the recording, which I could then subsequently rewatch over the internet. And that service would have been, or his preaching would have been beamed to all of the other churches that are a part of his franchise.
Once again, it goes to my "you can't make this stuff up" thing mind, you know.
It blew my mind that this is a normal thing for a huge part of America. And then one thing I never got to see, but I've seen videos of it, is baptism, where they have these huge bathtubs, you know, on stage, and they dunk people in the bathtub and baptize them. I've seen videos of what baptism looks like, but that's also a massively theatrical event. A good portion of America, you know, lives like this. It's very meaningful to them. And it's really easy to be arch about it. But I don't actually feel that way anymore, because there's, you know, Christianity's been around for a couple thousand years and is an incredibly important part of the lives of many people, not just in the United States, but around the world. And in many instances, there are reasons why. I remember I was almost 2 years ago, I was at a bar in Oakland with a friend who's a jazz singer, and a bunch of truck drivers, and then some random people in Oakland, and we got to talking about Jesus, and somehow we ended up talking about my book, and I said something like, well, you know, God loves people because people are in the city, which is a line that somebody had used with me, that's in the book. And I just remember all of these people saying, that's exactly right, you know. And suddenly I had this level of connection with total strangers, because I was saying something that I believed to be true, and a true teaching of Christianity. And they were agreeing with me. And I thought, wow, that's the power of this religion, that there are these people who take Jesus's message this seriously, and that his message was one of equality. And if you use that in the right context, you know, you can feel like you're making a connection with people. It's really interesting. And then there's the bullshit way that it's used too, right? Which is the infomercial, fill out this mailing card and join my church way, which feels less authentic. And also in the book, there are these scenes where Justin gets really agitated and says, you know, Jesus never said we had to join church, which is true. all around America. There's people starting these massive churches and with franchises and all this incredible electronic equipment. And Justin says, look, he didn't say we had to have church. He didn't even say we had to go to church, which is true. He never did. This nonsense that we've created in this country.
Yeah, and it's fairly clear. I mean, if Jesus came back today and went to the Vatican and said, what are you doing with all these jewels and gifts all immediately? What are you, crazy?
Well, when people get excited and say, like, Jesus is going to come back, I'm like, no, he's not. We haven't made any progress.
If he came back, he would be in Guantanamo within a week.
I totally agree with you. And this is, again, when I was saying that for any sort of spiritual practice to be authentic, it's got to be something that would work in a place like Guantanamo. If it doesn't work in Guantanamo, it's not working, right? If you have to buy your Goop energy stone and vagina steamer, that's probably not an authentic form of spirituality, because I don't know that anybody, maybe in Guantanamo they want that. I have no idea, but it's probably not and probably isn't what the real thing is.
Who's the, I don't know if it's Dawkins, who's the atheist that you, out of kindness, don't quote to?
It is Dawkins.
Yeah. And I don't have it in front of me, but that's the problem. It's like you're telling me there's a massive amount of America that does all this. And normally I would want to say to them, here, read this.
Right.
But I wouldn't do it because it would hurt their feelings. But I mean, but you kind of, that's, he's right. I've always thought he was right.
Dawkins?
Yeah.
Right. Would that be meaningful to people in Guantanamo, though?
No.
Yeah, I don't think so either.
No, it wouldn't be. I'm just talking about, I guess I want to use the word truth, but it's not really the right word, is it? It's strange.
Well, I think whatever the truth is, it's a hard thing. And that's why I think Justin in the book says, I hope there is a truth and I hope that it's good. I hope, right?
Like, yeah.
Those of us who want the world to be good and want the lives of people in Guantanamo and on death row, and we want all of these lives, like, those of us who really, really want all of these lives to matter, we really hope that, you know, our wanting these lives to matter is a thing of value. I still believe that it is and that it is a thing of value and that it matters. It's just that the crystals in the vagina steamer are probably not part of what makes our best selves matter.
So you say.
And I'm not sure that the degree to which Richard Dawkins is adamant is part of what matters or is the solution either, even though I subscribe to the theory of evolution over creationism. But I also don't think that the whole point of why Jesus came had to do with him. I don't really remember the part in any of the four Gospels where he says, you know, there's a causal relationship and God is in charge of everything. And the most important thing I have to teach you is that that evolution is wrong. Because I kind of think that's probably not in the four Gospels. And the needing to take control of the narrative in that way, I think, is a modern construction.
So if we were talking about you wrapping your head around Christianity, so here's one that I always have a problem with. And it's like the Pink Floyd song again, too, because once in a while I think I got it. It's like, okay, I understand the Father, and I understand, as you talk about in the book, his only son doing this. But I don't understand the Holy Spirit. I don't understand the Trinity.
Oh, once, I'm not sure I do either.
Once in a while, I kind of figure it out. Once in a while, like for 30 seconds, I know what the Holy Ghost is, but then it goes away. There's no way I could ever explain it. It just kind of comes into my head.
Yeah, I still struggle with the crucifixion. And I struggle with the, you know, he gave his only son thing, because like that just seems like a really mean thing to do to your child. And the escaping death thing, But there was a wonderful book that I read that's a Christian text, and I forget the name of it, but it's by, I remember the guy who wrote it, I think his last name is Ekblad or Elkblad. I'm sorry, I'm messing up his name. But he took the gospel, you know, he was raised in like one of these, you know, avoidant feel good churches, and then he went into quote unquote difficult areas. With the idea that if the gospel can't apply in death row and in prison and in third world countries, then it doesn't apply. And so he finds the ways in which the words mean something and brings the text to life again for him. And I forget where I was going with this. Oh, so in those moments, and there's something in there about how somebody who's on death row feels comforted by having the presence of Jesus with him. And I was like, okay. That I can buy. I get it. This person's being, it was somebody, you know, unjustly condemned to death, who felt that Jesus and his experience was accompanying him every single step of the way. And I thought, oh, that's, duh, of course, that matters.
I have a book at my bookstore called Last Meal of Texas Death Row Inmates.
Yeah, I've seen that.
What would you have?
I looked at that book and, I thought, gosh, I'm so indecisive. I would really have a hard time picking a last meal, but I do periodically ask myself that question, and I have yet to have an answer, because I was like, well, would it be like really high grade sushi, or would I just want junk food, or would I not be able to eat? I mean, I just don't know.
I probably wouldn't be that hungry, but, mostly it was steak, baked potatoes, milkshakes, french fries.
Right.
But why not? I mean, yeah. But now I don't want to seem, I might have picked fried chicken, but now I'm never going to be able to.
Get some good Korean fried chicken. I think they are like the masters of fried chicken.
I know. We just, a Korean fried chicken place just opened like 5 miles away from me in the middle of nowhere, near where your buddies live. And,
wonderful.
It's called Ori, O-O-R-I. And, yeah, it's the best wings you'd ever have. But now, of course, it's not the same because you have to pick them up and they don't taste the same because you have to eat them right when they're done. But anyway.
Yeah. Well, this too shall pass.
Yes. All right. Well, this has been an hour and a half.
Oh, my gosh. This was fun. Thank you.
Okay. We just had the longest and most wide-ranging interview of my life with Marie Mutsuki Mockett, author of American Harvest, God, Country, and Farming in the Heartland. Great book. I really enjoyed talking to her. It must have gone on for like an hour, hour and a half, whatever. In any event, one of the best interviews, well, the most fun I've had in an interview in a long time. So come back and see us next week. We will have upcoming, we have the third of my consciousness series of books. This is consciousness researcher Philip Goff, who will be discussing his latest work, which is called Galileo's Error, Foundations for a New Science of Consciousness, and National Book Award finalist Elliot Ackerman, who's going to be talking about his latest novel, Red Dress in Black and White. So join us as always. Thanks a lot for being here as a listener, especially in these times, at The Avid Reader.